Good evening to you. I'm Gregston Seeley. Please stand by for the usual edition of the Better Health Radio Show. Good evening, doctors. Good to have you back on the Better Health Radio Show.
Hi, good evening, Gregston. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. You hearing me loud and clear now?
I am hearing you loud and clear. Are you hearing me?
Yes, please. You can go right ahead, please.
Fantastic. All right, so good evening to our listeners. As always, it's a privilege to be here with you on Better Health, a program which is aimed at raising public awareness about common health issues that affect us all. Really happy to be here this evening, although we are talking about a pretty heavy topic. I know the mood in Barbados over the last week and a half, it's been heavy. It's been a very difficult time. We've had a number of persons who unfortunately have taken their own lives, and you know, it really should cause us to stop and pause and think. And I think that it's done just that. There's been a lot of public conversation around it, and so this evening we thought it fitting on Better Health to recognize where we are as a nation and to bring this topic to you. As usual, we do want your interaction. We want to hear from you this evening. Remember, you can call us at 434-1790, that's 434-1790, or you can send your WhatsApp messages to 266-4862, 266-4862, but we are going to be looking at suicide. We're going to be looking at it specifically around young people. It's heartbreaking to lose anyone by suicide, but I think that when you see young persons taking their lives, a lot of people stop and ask, but you know, you had what was the reason? You had so much life ahead of you. What leads a young person to do this? And so it's something that we really do have to look at. This evening, as usual, we have our guests on board, and we like to say nothing for the youth without the youth. And so we're so happy to welcome Mr. David Johnson. And you're going to hear a very familiar voice, Dr. Keo Fortin. Oh, she is a usual host on this program, but this evening, because of her expertise, she is a psychiatrist. She will be sitting as a guest of the program to answer your questions and give us that useful information that we need. But let me just tell you a little bit about our guest, as I usually would. Mr. David Johnson is a 24-year-old medical student. He's in his final year, so we will soon be calling him doctor. He is the president and founder of Let's Unpack It. He is best known for his tireless advocacy in the Caribbean mental health space, as well as his passion for youth empowerment. David is a regular presenter at youth development workshops and wellness seminars, and makes frequent appearances in the media to speak on all matters regarding youth mental health. He envisions a Caribbean region where every citizen can enjoy their right to the highest attainable standard of holistic health and wellness. On the wards and through his advocacy, he applies his efforts to make this vision a reality. Dr. Keo Ford St. Hill, like we said, she's a co-host here with us, but she's a part of the University of the West Indies, having studied at both Mona and Cato campuses. And after receiving her MBBS, she went on to complete her Doctors of Medicine in Psychiatry. She is currently a senior registrar at the Psychiatric Hospital, assigned to the Community Mental Health Team. Let me say a warm welcome to our guests, Mr. David Johnson and Dr. Keo Ford St. Hill. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good evening.
Yes, it's good to have you both, even though, like I said, it's a heavy topic. Now, people might say, why are we discussing this? We had some people commit suicide, yes, but why are we discussing this? But let me give you some statistics. World Health Organization would indicate that we have about 700,000 people die by suicide a year. Just to put that in perspective, you're looking at a person taking their life every 40 seconds. I want that to sink in. Every 40 seconds, somebody makes the decision to take their life in the world. And so it's a discussion that we definitely need to have. Now, David, I'm going to start with you because I'm really interested. I love to see young people getting involved in health advocacy without even, you know, being pushed or coerced. I'm really interested in hearing a little bit about Let's Unpack It. If you have not been following Let's Unpack It on Instagram, what are you doing? What are you doing? You need to find them excellent resources for mental health, colorful, informative. So I'm going to ask you, Mr. Johnson, tell us a little bit about your organization and what inspired you to start it in the first place.
Thanks so much, Dr. Lewis. Such a pleasure to be here. Good evening to all of our listeners. Let's Unpack It started back in January 2020, really as a need for a safe space for young people to come and discuss and learn more about mental health and wellness. I had known for a period of time that, you know, mental health was not something that we discussed openly. And that all came to a head late in January 2020 when I posted something on my my social media, and the responses that I got about how people were coping with stress and not having access to resources, that was quite telling. And so we created that initially as a safe space for young people to discuss and learn about mental health. But of course, we know that January 2020, just before the genesis of the COVID pandemic, and it, of course, coming to Barbados and affecting young people there, it was really out of a sense of frustration that we were not seeing a lot being done as it related to mental health within the COVID-19 pandemic. Young people not having access to a number of resources during that period that led us to pivot from that awareness to more of a digital advocacy. And so for the past 3 years, we've been doing a lot in terms of building community awareness, building mobilizing young people for action around that. And we've had the benefit of working in alignment with Healthy Caribbean Coalition and most recently UNICEF to help move forward action. And I love the way you started this program with the idea that there can be nothing with nothing for youth without the youth. And so that's exactly what we're calling for. Youth-led, youth-focused advocacy on mental health.
Absolutely, absolutely fantastic work. I have to applaud you and your team. Really, really good work. Like I said, if you're not following them, please find Let's Unpack It on Instagram. So you talked about the need for mental health resources for our young people. And I dare say for people altogether, because we do recognize that while there's a certain age group of persons that are at higher risk, you know, anybody can make the decision to commit suicide. Anybody can do with mental health issues. And so I think you offer great resources for persons of all ages, as far as I am concerned, to be very honest. Dr. Fortin, I want to bring you in on the discussion at this point, because, you know, we often see these reports in the media and people ask, why, you know, what were the signs? All of these questions we have, we're left with more questions than answers. And so I'm wondering if you can enlighten us as to what are some of the risk factors, what are the things that put people at risk of, you know, likely ending their life by suicide?
Good evening, everyone. It feels good to be on this side. So everybody, that's definitely a question that everybody asks, because everybody thinks, well, you know what, what signs did I miss? And the one thing I want to leave with our listeners is that, yes, they may be persons who you may have missed these signs, but in truth and in fact, there are actually quite a few persons who do commit suicide who may not show any of the signs that I'm about to list. And sometimes what we find is that people who actually complete attempts at self-harm to actually commit suicide actually never told anybody. Some of them never told anybody that they even wanted to harm themselves. But with that being said, these are, of course, those are not the typical presentations. So a person who has a mental health condition, so whether that is depression or a psychotic illness, particularly those who have like hallucinations, hearing voices or negative thoughts or intrusive thoughts, you know, who that are very negative, those persons would be at increased risk for suicidal ideations, which is what we call them. If you use substances, so such as alcohol or cocaine, marijuana, hallucinogens, any kind of drugs that you abuse. And then particularly, there are certain age groups. So when you're looking, we are definitely more cautious of persons who are like between the ages of like 15 to 24. Even though in Barbados, we don't necessarily see a lot of adolescents actually completing suicide, but worldwide, that you know, that there are increased risks. So we look at the extremes of life. So when they're in their adolescence or early adulthood, but also then when you are reaching the, I would say probably the third phase of your life. So persons in their 30s and 40s may not necessarily be the persons who we are most concerned about, but we're concerned about every person. The persons who then will be in their 50s and 60s and approaching retirement and post-retirement are the persons who we are a little more cautious with. And those are for other, goes into other risk factors, because at that stage in your life, your life changes. A lot of us, our life has been about our job for a very long time. And the change of going into retirement where you no longer have your day-to-day routine, you no longer, some of your friends have passed away, your spouse may have passed away. So a lot of social support, or family support, or even social support, because you know you have friends who are closer to you than relatives, a lack of social support is one of the risk factors as well. So then, of course, you're looking at somebody who's been through maybe a traumatic experience, or somebody who's been abused, or someone who has lost a relative or been in a major accident, someone who has experienced loss of function. So let's say you got an accident and you can no longer work doing what you were doing before, or someone who has had economic hardship. So they've lost their job, they've lost their house, they lost their wife, they lost the friends that they had because they no longer have those things. So those are just some of the risk factors.
Yeah. I just want to get this particular question right away. So we talked about the risk factors, but would one of those risk factors be asking a person if they're thinking about taking their life? So say you saw signs that were concerning. You said to that person, mm-hmm. you know, have you ever thought of harming yourself or taking your life? You started that discussion. Would that be considered a risk factor? Would it then propel no. that person?
Yeah, that is one of the things. I know a lot of persons get very scared to ask somebody if they're concerned about them, to ask them if they've ever had thoughts of harming themselves or killing themselves. But asking somebody about suicide or self-harm thoughts does not increase the risk that the person will attempt to harm themselves. In fact, you could save somebody from doing something very detrimental to themselves by actually recognizing that there's something that's a little off, or they're not quite themselves, and you ask, well, you know, have you ever had thoughts about harming yourself? Because some people who say they feel down, sometimes that's what happens. So I just want to know, have you ever had thoughts about harming yourself? That doesn't mean the person is more likely to go and do it. So it is always safer, because I was explaining to someone today, I probably, on a packed day, I probably asked about 30 people in a day, have you had thoughts about harming yourself? Because I have to ask every single patient who comes in front of me, regardless of what it is you're coming for. And it doesn't matter.
I'm glad that you're saying that, because it kind of allays the fear of people. You can ask the question. You know, you're not bringing this suggestion to them if they've been thinking about it. Trust me, they've been thinking about it. We have a caller on the line. So, caller, good evening. Welcome to Better Health.
Yes, thank you very much. Great evening. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Oh, wonderful. Well, you know, I more than need a touch from you, more than all of my blessings come from you, and you've more than touched me with your presence. Let me multiply.
Glad to hear that.
Praise the Lord. Let me multiply. Thank you very much. Thanks for being my source. Let me multiply the wellness of the program in terms of the issue of balance in relation to this particular form of severe mental health or mental illness or a mental health imbalance, where anything from chemical disorder to disorder in the workplace, disorder in the home, disorder at school, wherever you may be. You know, you might be thinking about harming yourself, as was just mentioned, but at the same time, you think you can function. And this is where my question is coming at, Dr. Ford. I'm St. Hill. Good evening to the panel. Thank the production for taking my call. What about the aspect of balance in terms of a holistic balance blended between what I was just mentioned, the work life, the home satisfaction and so on from your wife or from your husband, depending on. And so how important is the role of balance in terms of your mental health playing this? Because we know we're going to get the outside stimuli, we get the inside stimuli. There is disorder outside and disorder in our bodies, but what is the role of balance in that? And to Mr. Dave, the gentleman there on the panel.
David Johnson.
Thank you very much, David Johnson. Could basically call him Dr. David Johnson. He is doing a very good job. I think this is what we need more of in Barbados today and going forward, in how we're able to give a wonderful piece of even legislation where, you know, you can have your mental health in place based on the systems, the functions available, the psychiatric hospital, the polyclinics, the private, and everything. So therefore, my question is, in a person who may be able to function but may not be functioning at full capacity, or are struggling with suicide, are struggling with mental health in general, what is the state of your organization, as well as your knowledge? I want to hear your take on people who are struggling but are getting through. So we'll go back to the question of balance. It blends in nicely in terms of balancing your outside world, but in terms of a person who is kind of imbalanced but not all together there. So they're wondering, they're in that particular position of the your aspect of having your that person who may be functioning but not being able to do everything in terms of struggling. How does that struggle relate to him going forward? He cannot live a life that his life must be better. Where do you play in that? Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I'll go for this. Yes. Thank you so much for that, caller. Balance is very important. What I try to reassure persons is that balance for each person looks different, and it's going to look different at different stages, but not even to generalize it that much, but even month to month balance. I look at life as a pie. So if you have a pie and we have a slice for work, a slice for family, a slice for spirituality or the church, your religion, a slice for exercise, just all the different slices that make up your life, right? The sizes of those slices will change depending on the stage that you're at. So they're never all going to be 8 equal slices or 6 equal slices, because if you have a child who is doing common entrance at that time, then family is going to take up quite a bit more of your time than maybe even your exercise or your social time with your friends. And it may even take over from work at that point. Maybe when you have a project going on at work, the other slices start to get a little smaller. But once you are balancing, so that looks different for everybody, because everybody doesn't have children. Everybody doesn't have a spouse. But balance may be spending time with your mother and your sisters, going on hikes, all these different things. And I just encourage everybody to nurture each aspect of your life. So don't focus so hard on your career that you completely forget about the loved ones that you have. Don't, because some people may not be there when you're ready then to focus on them, you know. So you have to just strike a balance with everything. Sorry to use the word over and over, but just the long and short of it is balance is very important, and balance looks different for each of us. So somebody may spend less hours at work than myself or Dr. Lewis, and they may be able to spend more time at home, but you maximize the time that you have with your loved ones, because we know we have jobs that pull us away quite often.
Excellent. If I could jump Dr.
Sindhu. Sure. Certainly.
I think the response, it might be helpful to clarify what mental health really is, because I think that is something that people don't really appreciate often. And this is why sometimes we have a challenge even in terms of a national conversation about mental health. Often when you ask people what is mental health, they instantly think of a group of symptoms, or they think of a particular condition, like most likely schizophrenia, where you see certain symptoms. But when we talk about mental health, we're generally talking about a state of well-being where a person can cope with stress, they recognize their potential, they can maintain healthy relationships, and they can contribute to their society, right? And so if we look at these particular categories, we can appreciate that everyone is going to experience stress, but the degree of coping is what we're really talking about. So when you talk about someone who is able to maintain a certain level of functioning, but at the end of the day, they're not coping well, then we're saying that their mental health is really deteriorating. And I think what would really help here is to kind of teach people what are the signs that I'm looking out for in terms of to know that my mental health is deteriorating. Is it my hygiene is impacted? Is it that my work life is impacted? Is it that, you know, I really am just not feeling that great? And it can be a kind of an amalgam of these kind of things, right? But I think the reality is people cannot practice what they're not taught. And so when asked the question about what can an organization like Let's Unpack It in the third sector do, I think there's room for more awareness campaigns. There's room for more organizations to get involved in our schools. Of course, on the matter of legislation, people are probably tired of hearing my voice as it relates to a comprehensive national mental health policy, a comprehensive national mental health action plan, because it can no longer be this kind of pitchy-patchy approach where we have this tragic event, and then we have this two-day conversation, and we go back to normal. We need to have a comprehensive action plan that looks at teaching people, what are the signs, teaching people how to cope, understanding that vulnerability does not equal weakness. Rather, reaching out for help says, hey, I want to be better. I want to be able to function better, and this is where I can get my strength. By reaching out to my therapist, by reaching out to my community, and let's have a real, real conversation about how I'm doing and how can I be better. I think all of these things in unison can help, make sure that our young people are able to cope better, to know that it's okay to reach out for help, and to know that, hey, when I am feeling this way, that help is available and I am going to be better so long as I practice these particular strategies.
Yeah, and I just want to say those are excellent comments, Mr. Johnson, because we recognize the need. We talk about NCDs, for example. A lot of people don't see mental disorders as a part of the NCD package. But I think that we're coming to the place, and I'm hoping, just recently at the SIDS conference, we saw this focus on mental health, and that is encouraging. But what we want to see is movement from words to action. It's okay to have these conferences and highlight it, and but we really want to see action. We need it desperately at this time. I feel like more than ever, we want to see, like you said, the legislation. We want to see a comprehensive plan. So excellent points from both of you. I wanted to ask, though, because Mr. Johnson, you brought up the point about people knowing the signs, and I'm not going to speak to the signs of mental illness specifically, but because we're talking about suicide, I wonder what are some of those signs that persons might look out for as it relates to a person who is at risk for taking their life. What are some of these signs that a person might show in that period while they're contemplating? I'll throw this out to Mr. Johnson, you go ahead.
Sure. Yeah. We tend to break those down into three target areas, right? Things that people are talking about, things that people are feeling, and changes in behavior. So if someone is frankly saying to you, look, life is so hard, I feel depleted of hope, I feel like I don't want to be here anymore, that's a warning sign that you should flag. If it is someone that you know has been struggling with a chronic illness for a long time, and they've been speaking of, they're, wanting to give up, or they feel this intense shame or guilt around that, that's a warning sign that you should look out for. In terms of feelings now, you're talking with a friend and you hear them expressing the fact that, they're extremely sad, they feel empty, they feel hopeless. That's something that you should be concerned about. And of course, if they're describing unbearable physical or mental pain, strain, that's something that you should also be concerned about. But in terms of changes in behavior, extreme mood swings, risky practices, increased consumption of alcohol and drugs, and of course, making plans for a funeral, making plans or having a very detailed method of wanting to harm themselves, then that is definitely a sign that someone is really contemplating. And I think the question that follows up is, what do you do if you see these warning signs? And I think, again, sometimes we're very scared to ask that question. But like Dr. Fortune Hill was prefacing before, the idea that when you ask someone, hey, I've seen this change in your behavior, and I feel as though something may be wrong here. Is there anything you want to talk about? That is actually a concept that we call building hope. The idea that someone cares, the idea that someone is taking time out of their busy schedule to check in on me and say, hey, I'm concerned about you. And then, of course, if you are definitely concerned, they have a detailed plan on how this will happen, that is the time for you to intervene. It's no longer a matter of confidentiality because they are a threat to themselves. That's definitely where you want to get that person into a position of safety and into a position of help as well.
Yeah, excellent, excellent points. You know, it's really sad. Sometimes people say these things, display these behaviors, and yet people will say things like, oh, he or she's just looking for attention. People that cry out in this way, unfortunately, are seen as attention seekers. And sometimes what they do is that they cry out for a period of time, and then once they're ignored, they go on and complete the plan. And then we sit back and say, oh, but where were the signs? And of course, this is never ever to cast blame on family or friends, because we never want to do that. You know, I know that people may feel guilty, you know, when loved ones complete suicide. But this is never to cast blame, but it is to say for those of us who have people around us that may be showing the signs, you know, you should never look at it and think this person is just looking for attention. But you should always take these things seriously. That's really, really important. I wanted to ask you today, but another follow-up question. People keep asking why is this happening? What do you see as some of the major factors that are contributing to difficulties surrounding mental health and also contributing to suicide among our young people? And more importantly, do you think enough is being done to address these factors?
I'll answer the last question first and to simply say, no, we're not doing enough.
I figured that would be the answer.
And I'll tell you why. I think if we cast our mind back into history in terms of what was the conversation like around mental health 50 years ago versus where it is now, we'll see that we haven't really moved that far along the spectrum in terms of advancing the cause, right? We know that there has been a very tragic history surrounding mental illness. How that was used as a way to ostracize people, to lock them away from society and castigate them. And I think in some ways we have still stuck with that, in as much as we haven't done enough to reduce the level of stigma. We haven't done enough to boost awareness. And so when I talk about a comprehensive mental health action plan, it has to include that kind of effort. It means that a young child coming up through school may not be able to process the in-depth symptomology of schizophrenia, but of course they would be able to identify, well, look, if I have red to green on a scale on the wall of smiley faces and I'm feeling sad, then I know red is sad and green means I'm happy, right? A simple conversation about the emotions and the emotional chart, that would be great in our primary school, right? So that's the point of a lack of awareness. So at this point, I think the average Barbadian sadly does not have a good command of the mental health terminology. And that, again, is not to blame anyone, but to simply say we haven't done enough to bring up that level of, people-centered, empathetic language and culture around mental health. And simply put, if you're not teaching people about it, then they can't have the conversations that we need them to have. That's number one. Then, of course, the idea of a lack of support. I think we always hear, let's go back to the idea that it takes a village to raise a child, right? And I know, for instance, that we've had this kind of cultural shift where it seems as though no one wants to speak to the young people anymore because they're too aggressive and they will curse you out. I reject that notion. I reject the idea that young people are so reluctant to get help, right? I think that if you see a young person heading down the road and they really don't look as if they're coping well, if you see a young child in your classroom and they're not coping well, it takes only a couple seconds to sit with that child and say, hey, I noticed that you don't seem that great. How can I help? And then, of course, it's not even sufficient to have those kind of conversations even within families, but we need to know that there are services that are available. And while, of course, I know that, you know, government has talked about increasing the allocation of psychologists and psychiatrists to our community-based department, I think it's time that we kind of shift the kind of approach away from that institutional-based model to more of a community-based service offering, so that we see these kind of discussions happening within our community centers, that everyone in a community knows, hey, this is who I call within my immediate community if I have a mental health concern. So access to services has to be more than just offering, you know, more in terms of the offerings at our psychiatric hospital, but branching those out and making sure that everyone knows how to access them.
I think you've given us a very comprehensive answer. I think you should run for parliament, sir. Start to roll out some of these things. I'm sure there are some people waiting to vote for you. Yes? I'm going to take pause now. I had another question, follow-up question for Dr. Ford St. Hill, but we're always happy to have our callers on board. I understand that we have a caller. Welcome, caller, to the Better Health Program.
Question, good evening to you and your guest.
Thank you, kindly, sir.
Good evening.
And I want to tell you, ladies, I don't encourage the gentleman to get involved in politics. That would taint him.
Oh, dear.
That,
very well.
That might send you down Black Rock. Anyway, I joined the program. I joined the program later, so, but I know you're talking about psychiatry and that kind of thing. But this is the question I got to ask. It might sound like a foolish question, but I think it is very relevant. I want to know if a person that tries to break up families and break up husbands and wives and break up good friends, that person, and I mean, do it without any kind of remorse. You think a person like that is normal?
If a person like that is normal, I want to throw that to Dr.
That conversation is going to be too long of a conversation to have in this forum. But thank you for that. What I would say is that I don't use the word normal versus somebody who's not normal. We generally don't make diagnoses based on one complaint. So that's a much more complex conversation that we could probably look at adding on to our roster in the future, with persons who have difficulty with relationships relating to other people. We can discuss that later, because there are many things that could be as a result of. But thank you for that.
If I could add here, Dr. Lewis, just the concept again that mental health exists on a spectrum. And I think that the caller, and for the general public listening as well, we need to appreciate the concept that everybody has mental health. Mental health exists on a spectrum from optimal functioning all the way over to very poor mental health and in need of intervention. And so I think rather than saying normal, what you might want to say is that person in a state of proper functioning. And I think that's where the focus of the conversation surrounding mental health really ought to be at a national level.
Excellent point.
Okay, yeah, so well, I think I get it. And during the program, you can pick at it little bit by little bit. I might get more out of y'all when you pick at it. But I know the daughter says it's a long conversation to be had.
It's a very long conversation, and today we are casting our focus onto suicide and suicide prevention. So that's why.
But what I see, I am not a doctor by no stretch of the imagination. But
you are very knowledgeable.
I
said you are very knowledgeable. We know that.
Well, I thank you for thinking that I'm knowledgeable. But I would just want to say that I believe anybody who, before disdain, try to do these kind of very vicious and atrocious things to people, I think that person is normal. That's what I think. But like I say, I will let you all to pick at it as you go along, and I might get a little better understanding. Anyway, you guys have a great weekend.
Thank you so much, caller. Thanks for calling in. So, Dr. Forsenho, I have a question for you. Every time we hear that somebody, you know, has lost their life to suicide, we immediately think this person, we talk about mental illness.
Yeah.
We immediately assume that this person must have had some diagnosis or the other.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that? Is there always a link between a mental disorder and suicide?
What I would say
is
that,
factors?
Right. So if you reach the point
Dr. Forsman Hill, I don't think we're hearing you. Hello?
Sorry about that. Y'all still hearing me?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay. Sorry about that. A call was coming in. Sorry. If you reach the point where you have no hope and you feel like the only way out is to take your own life, then there's something that's definitely wrong. And it means that at that time, you definitely were not mentally healthy. So if we look at the concept that David was explaining of what mental health is, because it is very, I think it's a very difficult concept for persons to grasp, because we think that if you're mentally healthy, it means that you just don't have a mental illness, but that may not be the case. You, as David mentioned earlier, it is how you are coping with the stressors of life. So we, in most cases, the person may, let me not say most, yes, in most cases, there is an underlying mental health issue. Let me say that. That is probably the best way of putting it. The person may not have a diagnosed illness. They may never have seen a mental health professional. But there's definitely a link between mental health issues or mental health problems or poor mental health and completed suicide.
All right. Thank you for that. I think that's the important distinction to make, because people start to just assume things, and while they might, like we said, it may be an underlying mental health issue, you shouldn't just label people, you know. We have a caller on the line. Caller, good evening. Welcome to Better Health.
Yeah, this is the same person as 40 all this. No, I come back in because I heard the gentleman there saying that anytime a person is arranging their funeral, that's a person to watch. I beg to differ. There are people who arrange the funerals, pay the undertaker, and when they die, the family ain't got nothing to do but just bury them. So I would like to know from him on what grounds he's saying, if I heard him correctly, on what grounds he's saying that a person who arranges the funeral is a person to watch. I would like to know on what
grounds. I want to step in there before Mr. Johnson answers this, right? Because you did admit that you missed some of the program, right? So just to clarify, persons, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, which is that we can't make diagnoses or labels based on one behavior or based on one risk factor, right? So what Mr. Johnson was trying to convey, and I'm not speaking for him, but this is, you know, is that if you see somebody giving away all of their things, having planned their entire funeral in a perfectly physically healthy person who you otherwise would not have thought had any reason. So if you're speaking about somebody who is in their 80s and has done this, then that is completely different. They're coming on to the end of their life. We know that someone who has a terminal illness, then that's a different, it may be a different category. So it wasn't that he's just saying anybody who starts to plan their funeral, because I, you know, my friends and I have had discussions. We've said, you know, so I know which of my friends want mourning colors and which ones don't. But I do not think that they're at risk of hurting themselves. So it's a bigger conversation than that. One statement or one behavior does not make a diagnosis.
Because I was saying, Mr. Johnson,
I was saying that he probably said that because a person who is planning the funeral may be non-corpus mentis. So I thought that that's where he was going with it.
No, not at all.
Mr. Johnson, I'm trying to clarify.
Yes, I think Dr. Fortin Hill did a wonderful job of offering what I would have offered. And I think that in any case, any conversation, context matters. And so in the context of other symptoms, in the context of other risk factors that we have also mentioned during the conversation, is where we think that that would be a bit problematic and where you ought to really say, okay, let's have a conversation. And mind you, I think the purpose of this conversation is not for us to go around, labeling people and putting them into boxes, but rather that if you see any of these warning signs, particularly in unison, that you say, okay, maybe I should ask a question. Maybe I should inquire of that person, hey, is everything okay? Is there anything that I can do to help? Is there anything that you would like to talk about? So that really was the context for the statement that I made.
And perhaps, David, if you could just very quickly, literally just list some of those warning signs that we talked about for persons who may have missed it before, so that we get the context of what the caller is asking about. Just list them for us.
Right. So Dr. Saint Hill would have mentioned the risk factors before, but in terms of warning signs, I mentioned that they're broken down into three typical categories. And we made mention as well that warning signs are not always as overt as the list that we're giving. That's to say that not everyone who is contemplating that place who said will show these signs. But of course, if you see any of these signs, please have a conversation and be brave enough to ask, hey, is everything okay? Is there anything that you want to talk about? So number one, talking about, wanting to end their life, wanting to die, talking about a great deal of guilt or shame, or perhaps being a burden to all of those around them. Secondly, the idea of describing a feeling or emotion of being empty, hopeless, trapped, or not wanting to go on. They may also describe feeling, extremely sad, anxious, agitated, or full of rage. Or they may be describing that they're in an unbearable amount of emotional or physical pain. And then, of course, we look also for changes in behavior. And I would have mentioned earlier the idea of, withdrawing or saying goodbye, taking extreme risks. You're noticing extreme shifts in behavior or mood. Or, of course, if they're an increased level of using drugs or alcohol. And then, of course, I mentioned the idea of someone who's making a comprehensive plan. For instance, I know what means, I know what location, or I'm, giving away all of my items or making plans for the way that I will die, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. So it's within that context. It's not just that one, but it's within that context that we're talking about. These are warning signs. I want to go on because our time is well spent. Time goes so quickly. But I wanted to ask you, Mr. Johnson or David, the discussion that we had about how mental health was viewed for older generations is an important one that you brought up earlier. And so there seems to almost be a gap between what we understand as younger persons. I term myself as a younger person. So I put myself in that category. What we understand as younger people.
Yes, we are here. We are.
Thank you. Support. What we understand surrounding mental health and what older people might see as, their perception of mental health and mental illness, because we have to, the two kind of go hand in hand there on the spectrum that we talked about. What can we do to bridge that generational gap? Because at the end of the day, you talked about it takes a village. So we need all hands on deck. We need younger persons to have the support of older persons. They have the experience. They have knowledge. There are so many things that they can add. But what can we do to bridge that generational gap, to form these supportive relationships between older people and younger people so that persons can get the help that they need?
Such a wonderful question. I think one that all callers can take action on once it's answered. I think when we think back again over the course of let's say, 50 years, not much has changed in terms of the presentations that we see. But what has changed is that we're having a better discussion about it. or that there is access to more evidence-based information and there's access to greater awareness about terminology, right? So we often hear from persons in older generation, well, when I was young, I had a mental health and all that. Yes, you did have mental health. What you didn't have was the terminology to talk about it, right? So what an older person might describe as, well, I feeling bad, my mood bad, I got the bad feels, right? We may call that today, well, that's anxiety. It's the disproportionate level of fear that you're having in advance of something big coming up or for whatever reason, right? When somebody's saying that, you know, I'm in a state of grief, well, there's no distinction that's happening in terms of psychiatry between what is the typical grief that a person experiences between and comparing that to what is complex bereavement disorder, right? Mm-hmm. So what we have today is a better understanding of the terminology and a better understanding of cause and effect. And so what we really ought to do is to get serious about awareness. What we really ought to do is to utilize our community centers, for instance, as safe spaces that we can bring together people of all generations to have conversations. I think specifically to what the government is doing now with relevance to the Paris Speaks and how that has been a tremendous success in terms of having national conversations about matters that impact everyday citizens. So I think what we really ought to do is to have that kind of space for awareness. And once we have a level of awareness and education taking place, then we naturally have a level of stigma reduction. And so I think what we really need to do is to kind of, you know, build this idea that, you know, everyone experiences certain life challenges, everyone experiences certain life stresses, and here's how we can get through it, through a spirit of empathy, through a spirit of community, and through a spirit of everyone coming together with a common understanding that we have to do our part to prioritize mental health and wellness.
Excellent, excellent. I understand, like, seeing that we have a caller on the line.
Yes, good evening. This is Anthony Hope calling. Good evening.
Hi,
to good all evening. The listening audiences and to all the doctors, in whether you're in or out of the studio. I'm not getting all the names, so I don't want to get punished for calling one name and not the other. However, to chase to the point, I want to start with the word adaptability. And from adaptability, I'm looking at the interaction between environments. Environments meaning whether it be the physical environment of lands and properties and homes and being able to adjust. Environments in terms of interaction and language and speech, being able to adjust and adapt to what is going on with your interest, person or group, and the state of cognitive development in terms of good mental health. Now, what we are looking at is suicide. And as a result, you want to look at what would force a person to become unstable and not being able to adjust or adapt to the environment that leads to that very stringent stage where a person begins to internalize terminating life. Sir, could you give us some examples? Because I guess you are pro on this, dealing with so many persons.
Is that a question for Dr. Fortin Hill?
Yeah.
Dr. Fortin Hill, are you clear? Are you clear on the question?
I'm not clear.
The gentleman doctor.
Oh, okay. I'm not sure he's clear either.
I think what the caller is asking is whether or not we could be a bit more clear on the idea of what causes someone to go over the threshold. Am I reading you correctly?
Pardon me?
Okay, please clarify your question.
What I was saying is that we know that behavior is very unpredictable, very unusual, very different, very strange. But within the mechanism of being able to adapt to a particular environment, we're always saying that you need some guidance. You need someone to show you how to present your behavior projection or your character to keep your mental stability, in other words, to keep your brain stable. And let me give an example of what I'm trying to say. Let's say that there are two worlds. I live on one world that says a cat is a dog. And you live on the other world that says a dog is a cat. So we meet up and we look at this object passing, and you're saying it's a dog and I'm saying it's cat. Now, what is doing to our mental stability?
All right, so you're talking about differences in perceptions, I assume, how that affects people's mental stability, helping persons to manage adaptability as it relates to differences in perception?
Yes, that is what I was saying from the very start. And in terms of the fact that it's an interaction going on between human beings, for which the case is that some people become mentally unstable.
Okay, all right. Thank you so much, caller. I will throw that out to our guests. You can feel free to tackle that question how you wish.
Yeah,
but I gather that he's talking about dealing with differences in perceptions and how that can affect mental health, right? I gather that's what the question is.
Yeah, and I think that comes into play even in terms of what we said earlier about the very notion of mental health being the ability to cope, right? And so, for instance, when we talk about therapy and counseling and so on, we often think that only people who are, in a debilitated state, for instance, need to go seek help and from a therapist, a counselor, etc. But I think there's room for all of us to learn coping strategies, to learn, the idea that, we all face stress, but here are positive ways where we can navigate those particular stresses as they arise. And so I think, again, that is the benefit of things like peer support groups, the benefit of things like mentorship, the benefit of a level of awareness about mental health at its core, the idea that, I cannot foresee all the challenges that will come in my life, but I know that when I'm faced with a challenge, I can do these particular things, take particular steps like grounding, take particular steps like, opening up to a friend and saying, hey, this is what I'm going through and I need some help here. And when I feel as though I cannot cope anymore, then really seeking that level of professional help. So I think the idea of resilience is not always an innate thing. It's something that we also need to build. And again, I keep repeating the fact that we cannot expect people to practice what they're not taught.
Absolutely. All right. I think I'm hopeful that helps to address the caller's concerns. But I think it was a suitable answer for sure. Now, we like these sessions to be very practical, and we are coming down to the end of our time. And I think one of the things that is important for our listeners to walk away with would be, how can you help persons that are showing these signs? What are the resources that are out there? And not just signs of, the potential to complete suicide or self-harm, because we didn't talk about self-harm, but self-harm happens in different ways. But people who are going through a difficult time altogether, we often hear that there are not enough resources, and we agree to that, but there are some resources over there. And so where can people look to for help? I'm going to start with you, David, only because I know that Let's Unpack It, you prepared a very good resource kit for persons. I want to tell us a little bit about that, and then I'll jump over to Dr. Forsyth and Hill for her thoughts as well.
Of course. And I just really want to reiterate the point as well that reaching out for help, contrary to what we often hear, is actually one of the bravest, kindest things you can do for yourself in a moment of crisis and even before a moment of crisis. I think we have a lot of work to do to normalize help seeking, to normalize reaching out, to normalizing just saying, I need a little help. And I think there's probably a more of an uphill battle as it relates to our young men in particular who are struggling. What we've done at Let's Unpack It is to prepare a directory of resources, mental health and psychosocial resources for Barbados. You can access that through the link bit.ly/mentalhealth246. You can also find that by hitting on the link in our bio on all of our social media pages and our social media across all platforms, Let's Unpack It CO. That's LETS Unpack It CO. You can find this resource at the link in the bio. But of course, I think there's one number that all Barbadians should become familiar with, and that's 264-7151. 264-7151. That's CASA's mental health crisis support hotline. It's available every evening from 5 p.m. until 11 p.m. And so these are a few of the resources that are available. Of course, your first point of call can always be your GP or your pediatrician based on your age category. If you have any concerns relative to mental health, feel free to reach out there and they can offer referrals. And of course, there are a number of mental health supports through our schools as well. In terms of our guidance counselors there, the school psychologists and social workers working in the school environment. I just think it's really important not to just have the service, but that people feel empowered and hopeful about reaching out to these services as well.
Yeah, and I think a big part of that, David, is breaking the stigma around it. You know, we do have to work, and that's why conversations, you know, sometimes it can be frustrating talking all the time. You want to see action. But the more we talk, the more we begin to open up people's understanding, and the more we can begin to break down the stigma so that people can reach out for help. Dr. Keo Fortin Hill, can you tell us, would you like to add anything to what David has said? For example, if you have somebody, I don't know, in the middle of the night, and you're thinking this person might want to complete suicide or something like that, mm-hmm. How can that person find help?
Right. So I'm here smiling from ear to ear because David is making me very, very proud, and I look forward to the doctor that he is becoming. And I see that, you know, a lot of my words are not falling on deaf ears, so I'm very proud of him. And he did mention quite a bit. So the CASA helpline, there's also a helpline, which is all in the links and the documents that David was speaking about that Let's Unpack It has. The Barbados Professional Women's Club, they also have a crisis hotline. And then, of course, there is the QEH hotline, which I think is only now available until 10 p.m. or midnight now. But then there's also the Psychiatric Hospital Assessment Unit, which is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and that is manned by mental health trained nurses. And our assessment unit is open 24 hours, 7 days a week. You do not need an appointment to come and see someone there. And there's always a doctor on call or present there on the unit. And there are mental health trained nurses there as well. And as David explained, if you can get in touch with your general practitioner, if you can get in contact with your pediatrician, whoever, the ambulance service, the fire service, the police, it doesn't matter who it is, they will all channel you in the correct direction. And we are more than able, and well, yes, our resources are limited, we do a lot with the little that we have, and I love conversations such as these ones. The other thing I wanted to quickly, Gregston, just jump in and say, I wanted to comment on the spectrum of suicidal ideations. So there's the death wishes, so persons who may say, I just wish I would go sleep and not wake back up, but they don't actively have a plan or want to harm themselves. And then you have to the other end will be the persons who actually have a plan and actually attempt or try to harm themselves. And harming yourself may not always mean that you want to die. But I just want to make sure that our listeners understand that we should never say that somebody is just looking for attention, because even that behavior, for some persons, as annoying as it may be, is a cry for help and something is wrong. Yeah. That's just the one thing I wanted to leave.
Yep. I want people to take that away. Never ignore it. Don't push it. Don't say, oh, she, you know, here, she's just an attention seeker. Address it. One last thing I want to throw there, because I know we have to wrap up. We've been hearing this thing about suicide contagion. I've seen on social media people mention about suicide clusters or cluster suicide, and I don't think a lot of people understand what that is. Dr. Keo Forsing Hill, could you just tell us really briefly about that?
Right. So just very briefly. So while asking someone if they've had thoughts about harming themselves does not trigger somebody to commit or complete suicide or self-harm, someone who already has those thoughts, already had a plan, someone who is at high risk having seen another person or mention of somebody else committing suicide, it can, in some instances, it's not that it's a widespread thing, but in some instances, make them say, well, what is stopping me? You know, maybe I could do that. Maybe things would be better for me. Look, you know, that person is gone and everybody cried, but they got over it. So, which is why we are very, very big on the responsibility that the media has in how they report about it and not sensationalize suicide, because the research has shown that when you broadcast it, you know, showing bodies being rolled away or saying exactly the method that somebody used to commit suicide, it can create a chain reaction in persons who were already at risk. It doesn't usually do that in persons who have never had a thought, but in persons who are at risk. I just want to stress that part. So it's very important. It's not that we want to hide up things. It's not that the government doesn't want people to know things. That's not what we're saying. But what we're saying is we're trying to protect those who are at high risk.
Excellent, excellent point. I'm going to wrap up the program. I want to give both you, David, and Dr. Forrest Hill 1 minute or 30 seconds. 30 seconds, really quick. Closing thoughts. What do you want people to take away from this discussion? And David, I'll let you go first.
Well, I just want to thank you for the invitation to speak and offer the youth perspective to this conversation. And the one thing I do want to leave with our listeners is the idea that all of us have a role to play in helping to build hope and save young lives. I think too often we divulge responsibility onto somebody else, or somebody else will do it, or, well, dying out of my business. But the reality is, if you have the ability to save a life, if you have the ability to reach out to someone and say, hey, I'm concerned, hey, is there anything I can do to help, then that goes a long way. And of course, I do think that the government as well has a role to play in this, in terms of offering the high quality services that are necessary, doing more for awareness, and bringing that comprehensive mental health plan as a matter of urgency. Because coming soon is not any form of consolation to people who are struggling. Thanks so much.
Excellent,
excellent. You want to start the first 30 seconds really quickly? Thank you so much. What I want to leave for our listeners is that it is okay to ask for help. And asking for help doesn't always mean that you actually have to come and see necessarily a mental health professional. I always advocate that you start with making sure you have a trusted friend, colleague, a family member, somebody. Just have your person. Somebody that you can reach out to before we reach to this point. Somebody you can just vent to. So you just need to have a person. Then, you know, we escalate here. Maybe it's going to be a little more than your best friend can handle. Maybe your pastor, your somebody in the community who may have some training in mental health first aid or anything like that. And then, of course, always your primary care physician, your general practitioner, is a golden resource that I don't think we utilize as much as we should. And then, of course, as I said, there's a psychiatry department at QEH. You can go to ask the emergency no matter what time of the day, and you can be seen as well as at the psychiatric hospital.
Excellent. Thank you so much to both of our guests for joining us this evening. I just want to wrap up the show. The song that you heard by Libyanka at the beginning of the program, People, it sounds groovy, and I know a lot of people listen to it and bop to it, and they have no idea what it's about. I'm just going to read a few of the lyrics very quickly. It says, I've been drinking more alcohol for the past 5 days. Did you check on me? Did you look for me? I walked in a room, eyes are red, and I don't smoke banger. Did you check for me? Did you notice me? Nobody would know the paranoia, because I put a smile on my face, a facade you can never face. And if you don't know me well, you won't see how buried I am inside my grave. Because you see people, they don't really know you. And I just want to end this program by saying there are lots of people who are in this exact position, who have a smile on their face and they're thinking of ending their lives, or they're thinking of harming themselves. They don't want to be here. And if you're not checking in on people, if you're not noticing, you know, the difference in behaviors, if you're not asking, how are you? Not just as a form of introduction or to be pleasant, but genuinely, because you want to know. And because you want to help somebody who might be having a difficult time, we will continue to miss it. Did you check on me? That's the question. Did you check on that person next to you? Did you check on your colleague, your friend, your family? I want us to take these words, listen to this song at a point in time. Beat is great, but listen to the words. Consider if you are a person who's thinking nobody cares, you know, I just want you to know that there's hope. There's hope beyond this moment. And I am, you know, I'm really hoping and praying that you find that person that you can confide in this evening. Thanks so much for joining us this evening. Thank you, Gregson. You've been excellent as always. Thanks to our guests, Mr. David Johnson, Dr. Keo Fortin-Hill, and we look forward to joining you on another program of Better Health in the future.
Thank you so kindly, Doctor. This evening she had on deck another one of the hosts, Dr. Keo Fortin-Hill, and also she had David Johnson. In a year's time, to tell me he will be Dr. David Johnson, and he represented himself very well, I tell you, very well. So thank you, Dr. Keo Lewis. Until next weekend, you take care, all of you, and we'll come back and have another edition of the Better Health Radio Show next weekend at 6, right here on the VOB 92.9 FM on a Sunday evening, as usual. Take care.